Here's where we are on this Friday. The trade war might, and I stress here, might be winding down. A couple of iconic American brands, maybe, and I stress here, maybe, aren't so lucratively iconic anymore. And I don't know about you, but I am totally watching the Oscars on Sunday. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rosendahl. It is Friday, the 22nd day of February. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We got trade today, then some more trade, a little bit of trade as well, and then some Fed. How about that for a Friday weekly wrap? John Harwood is here from CNBC. Anna Swanson is with the New York Times. They are both in our studios in Washington. Hey, everybody.
Yo.
Hey, Kai.
Yo. So, Anna, let me start with you and ask you this. So there have been trade negotiations happening in Washington this week between the White House and representatives of the Chinese government. It does appear, based on your reporting and what the president had to say today in the Oval Office, that maybe that March 1 deadline that we've been thinking about for more tariffs being put into effect by the White House, maybe that's not a factor anymore?
Yeah, it sounds like both sides would really like to extend that deadline and come to more of a resolution before tariffs would go up from 10% to 25% on $200 billion of goods. That's a big hit to the U.S. economy. And it does look like talks this week have made progress. And the fact that the world's two biggest economies are even setting pen to paper rather than battering each other with tariffs is really a very good thing. But the president has set an extremely high bar for himself. And now there are other challenges with this agreement. And one of the main sticking points is still how to ensure that the Chinese actually adhere to any agreement that they sign. And it's kind of like nailing Jell-O to the wall. The Chinese have a long history of making these promises to reform their economy and then not necessarily following through.
So, John, let me ask you this. And I say this not at all pejoratively, but has the president in a way backed himself into a corner? Because he has staked so much on this deal. We have now signs that the Chinese economy, the American economy, and the global economy writ large are weakening. And if this thing falls apart, Katie, bar the door.
That's right. But I don't think it's going to fall apart, partly for the reason that Anna said, but also, as you suggest, both economies are in some difficulty. And the agreement is likely to be an agreement to keep talking. It's not going to be deep structural reform. That's something that requires patient, well-planned negotiations with allies over a very long time. This involves the president simply saying, I'm not going to do something to further damage our economy before the election year. And so I think the stars are lining up for a minimalist agreement that won't be much, but it won't be destructive.
All right. So, Anna, let me steal a page from one of our Friday colleagues, Catherine Rempel at The Washington Post, who had a piece today in which she said, basically, let's worry about the president perhaps learning the wrong lesson from this thing. That is to say, he's piling on all these tariffs and he's getting these negotiations going. But what we might wind up with is not a deep structural deal, as you were talking about earlier, but something much more simple and superficial.
Yeah, I think that's right. So I think the most likely scenario is that we do still end up with a deal where, you know, China makes a lot of purchases of American goods and probably rather vague commitments in other areas that they might not keep. And, you know, the president might take away the lesson that these threats of tariffs are effective for him at producing kind of a big headline deal with lots of purchases, something that he can call a win. And, you know, he's also doing that on many other fronts, for example, with auto tariffs on that he's threatened against the European Union and Japan that are could be a big disruption to relations there.
John, let me one more quick thing on trade and then I want to move on. We had, as you and I talked about in a brief email exchange yesterday, we had Christine Lagarde on the program, the managing director of the IMF yesterday. She talked about how worried she is about this trade deal. We're going to have Janet Yellen on Monday. And spoiler alert, she also is worried about this trade deal. There are nonpartisan observers who place great stock in this thing actually happening for fear of anything else.
Well, it needs to happen to avoid creating further harm. But if it's simply a mercenary deal where they buy more soybeans or some other equipment, maybe a little opening to the services sector, it's not going to be transformative. And it will simply be the president deciding not to engage in any more brinksmanship that would be counterproductive. Everyone's nervous because of how tenuous the situation with the global economy is, and the durable goods orders this week coming in soft is another reminder of that.
And also on a housing yesterday, there's a bunch of stuff, which is the transition to the Fed. The minutes from its most recent meeting came out yesterday. Was it yesterday? I can't remember. I've been traveling. And anyway, the Fed is basically keeping an eye on things, saying, listen, there are some signs of softening here, and the global outlook is of concern.
Yes. Yeah. And some people read that as the Fed kind of caving to markets.
Yeah.
Markets were pretty volatile in December because investors thought that Fed officials weren't sufficiently worried about the economy. The Fed's terms were insufficiently flexible. So the economy is generally doing well, but trade and slowing global growth do present risks. And the Fed has basically had to go from kind of playing checkers to playing chess here. There's just so much more they have to consider with slowing growth in China and Europe and trade tensions and the prolonged government shutdown. What all the effects of those things could be.
Speaking of effects, John, quickly on the way out here, I will call upon your years of experience in the Washington political and economic scene. Next week, we have President Trump meeting with Kim Jong-un. We have Michael Cohen, the president's former fixer on Capitol Hill. It will be, and this is charitable, a circus. Things will get lost and progress will not be made on a lot of other fronts.
That's right. We did learn today that the Department of Justice will not be receiving the Mueller report next week. So at least that's one thing that won't happen. but the North Korea talks are likely to be a different version of the China talks. A lot of noise, a lot of threats, a lot of brinksmanship that is going to end up with not very much. The first summit in Singapore did not produce anything in the way of a verifiable agreement. This one isn't either, but it's certainly going to take up a lot of media space next week.
For sure. John Harwood at CNBC, Anna Swanson for the New York Times in Washington for us this week. Thanks, you two.
Thank you.
You bet.
All right. Have a nice weekend. On Wall Street on this Friday, traders are going into the weekend. On an up note, we will have the details when we always have the details. Once upon a time, cheese in this country was spelled K-R-A-F-T. Oscar Mayer, come on, sing it with me now, had a way with B-O-L-O-G-N-A. But the owner of those brands, Kraft Heinz, has admitted that they are in some T-R-O-U-B-L-E. The packaged food giant said it's going to write down the value of Kraft and Oscar Mayer by more than $15 billion American dollars. Marketplace's Justin Ho explains why those iconic brands just ain't what they used to be.
Food companies like Heinz used to promote the fact that their food was sterile, scientifically prepared, untouched by human hands. NYU food studies professor Amy Bentley says things have changed.
Nowadays, we want people to touch our food. We want to know the farmer who's grown the apples or the grapes.
Consumers are favoring healthier foods from newer brands. A lot of legacy companies have responded to changing tastes by merging. In 2015, Heinz bought Kraft Foods, which included Oscar Mayer, for $45 billion. Evan Rawley, a professor of management at the University of Minnesota, says the $15 billion write-down of Kraft and Oscar Mayer means Heinz paid too much for the brands.
What they're saying is, we thought it was worth more than what we think it's worth based on the information we have today.
Kraft Heinz tried to revive the brands by cutting costs. John Stanton, a professor of food marketing at St. Joseph's University, says those cuts came with a downside.
You know, why don't we not have so many salesmen out there? Why don't we cut back on our advertising? That leads to less sales.
Kraft Heinz CEO says the company will look to consolidate further and maybe sell off some brands. Evan Rawley at the University of Minnesota says to truly survive, Kraft needs to create products that people actually want to buy.
You can't just keep cutting costs forever. You can't just keep growing your way out of trouble. You actually have to generate products that are useful for society.
A Kraft Heinz spokesperson says the company's beefing up its innovation and that it's still cutting costs. In New York, I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
There is real estate news of note today. Zillow's got a new CEO who happens to be the old CEO. The real estate media company, as it likes to call itself, announced the change as it delivered mixed fourth quarter profits. Co-founder and original CEO Richard Barton is going to take over from Spencer Raskoff, who's been in charge since 2010. Now, why the shakeup? Well, there might have been a hint in a conversation that I had with Spencer Raskoff last summer.
So just a couple weeks ago, we started buying and selling houses in Phoenix and Las Vegas, and later this year in other cities too.
How come? It seems a hair off the core competency.
It can seem that way at first. We look at it a little differently. As you point out, we're a data company, right? So what we have that no one else has is we have information on what houses people want to buy. And so we think that offering this service to the seller will allow us to match supply and demand between seller and buyer.
Marketplace's Amy Scott takes it from there.
Zillow was founded in 2005 by three guys, Rich Barton, Lloyd Frink, and Spencer Raskoff, and their roles have shifted over the years. In an earnings call yesterday, Barton called the latest shift a turning of the triangle. Outgoing CEO Raskoff will stay on as a board member, Frink will replace Barton as executive chairman, and Barton returns to the helm as CEO.
The reason we kind of turned this triangle is because I have a particular penchant for an attraction to big swings.
And Zillow is attempting a big swing. Say you're thinking about selling your house. In cities like Atlanta, Denver, and Phoenix, you can now request a direct offer from Zillow, and a local real estate agent will deliver it. If you take the offer, Zillow goes through that agent to buy your house, then flips it within 90 days. If you don't,
at least that realtor will have an opportunity to get in front of an incremental customer and potentially turn them into a client.
Analyst Brad Erickson at Needham & Company says for Zillow, it's not really about buying and selling homes. It's about ad dollars.
It's to increase their overall sphere of influence such that they can compel more real estate agents to advertise with them in the future.
After Zillow offers debuted last year, the company's stock lost nearly half its value. Steve Murray with real estate research firm Real Trends says Raskoff's been doing a good job, but Barton, who also founded Expedia and the career site Glassdoor, might be a better salesman.
I mean, the guy is clearly one of the brightest guys of our times. And they may have believed they needed someone of his stature to really execute these changes in their business model.
And to change some minds on Wall Street, Zillow shares were up about 25% today. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Raise your hand if you're at least a little bit curious about the Oscars on Sunday night. Sure, yes, who's going to win what, but also how the whole no host for the broadcast thing is going to go. It's a big-ish deal because the Oscars broadcast is coming off its worst ratings ever. The audience was down 19% last year from 2017, and honestly, the Academy's got a whiff of desperation about it as it tries to get more people to tune in. You remember the short-lived Oscars category for the best film that the public actually watched, most popular, I think it was? It also said it was going to give out some awards during commercial breaks to cut the running time, but bailed on that after a bunch of pushback. All of that said, though, the Oscars are doing just fine by perhaps the most important metric. Marketplace's Ben Radford has that one.
In 2001, 43 million people tuned into the Oscars to see this movie take home Best Picture.
Are you not entertained? Are you not entertained?
That is Gladiator. But last year, The Shape of Water's big win entertained 17 million fewer viewers. Analyst Jeff Greenfield at C3 Metrics says advertisers are undeterred.
Well, ad sales are through the roof. They're sold out.
Greenfield says with TV ratings declining across the board, live and particularly prestige events like the Oscars are actually more valuable than ever.
This is still one of the largest global audiences that you can get.
The cost of a 30-second spot has steadily risen to $2.2 million this year, according to Kantar Media. And companies treat the Oscars like a mini Super Bowl.
Every stage needs a star. Every road needs a ruler.
Cadillac alone bought 4 minutes of airtime, according to Ad Age. Media consultant Brad Adgate says companies may be betting the nomination of popular films will bring in more viewers.
If you want to look at Oscar ratings through the years, the most watched Oscar telecast was when Titanic won.
And Titanic's historic U.S. earnings were surpassed this year by one of Sunday's Best Picture nominees.
Wakanda forever!
In Black Panther, like Gladiator before it, the Oscars once again have the year's biggest blockbuster in the night's top category. I'm Ben Bradford from Marketplace.
Not to be forgotten about the Oscars broadcast, of course, is the red carpet. Who's wearing what and by whom and how much did they pay for it? Spoiler alert, they didn't. The business of dressing for the Academy Awards, it's at marketplace.org. Coming up.
What's in my water? I don't know if I can trust this now.
Yeah, maybe not. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials added 181 points this Friday, 0.7%, 26,031. The NASDAQ grew itself 67 points, about 0.9%, 75,27. The S&P 500 gained 17 points, 0.6%, 27,092. For the 5 days gone by, the Dow was up 0.5%. The NASDAQ added 0.7%. The S&P, come on, it's been a long week. The S&P 500 tacked on 0.6%. We talked about that $15 billion write-down from Kraft Heinz. Kraft Heinz's biggest one-day sell-off on record, 27% was the drop. Kellogg shares dropped 2.7% today. As we talked about, the Academy Awards on Sunday, the Oscars are going to be on ABC. ABC is owned by the Walt Disney Company. Disney shares up 0.8%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. There are, and this is according to the British government, there are more than 2 million people living and working in the UK right now who are citizens of other European countries. That matters, of course, because as things stand now, in something like 5 weeks, the UK is going to be leaving the EU. And one of the big drivers of the yes on Brexit vote back a couple of years ago was a promise to an end to what's known as freedom of movement, the EU's policy that lets citizens of any member state live and work in any other member state. That's going to change come Brexit Day, March 29th as it stands now, which is going to be a big deal for those 2 million people I was talking about. So with that as backdrop, here is the latest in our series, My Economy, stories of people making a go of it in this global economy. Today's installment comes to us from our partners at the BBC.
My name is Helen De Cruz, and I'm a senior lecturer of philosophy at Oxford Brookes University. Originally, I'm from Belgium. I grew up in Belgium. I moved to the UK first in 2011. I was very much taken with Southeast England and Oxford in particular, and I loved things like the architecture, the climate, the people. I think it's fair to say that the referendum result, when it was announced, was a big blow. So I felt really integrated. For instance, I regularly went to church, local church, and I even was part of the choir. But afterwards, I kind of felt like I'm not really truly part of these communities. I'm not really truly welcome here. I mean, sometimes you'd hear people say things like, "Oh, aren't you leaving yet? I thought we voted you out," but there aren't many people who said that. In terms of financial decisions, the main thing that Brexit has done is put me off buying a house. And it was kind of sad because my father-in-law recently died, and we have a big heavy painting that he made. And we were sort of looking forward to finally not be in rented accommodation anymore, but have our own house, because that would allow us to hang that heavy painting, because you would have to damage the wall in order to hang it. And the fact that it's still now upstairs, sort of wrapped in blankets to protect it, is kind of a testament to the fact that we sort of put our lives on hold and that Brexit has put our lives on hold. I have not applied for settled status. Nevertheless, I will apply in due course because I don't want to become an illegal immigrant. I think it will be difficult to apply. Also, there's no clear right of appeal. There's no clear instructions about what would happen if for some reason, even though it's difficult to imagine, given that I've always worked here and so on, but what if for some reason something goes wrong and the application is denied? I have no idea what to do in that case.
We need your help to make this series work, your stories specifically. Let us know how your economy is doing. There's a place you can do that at marketplace.org. We take you now to the western end of Lake Erie, the city of Toledo, Ohio, where next week there's going to be a measure on the ballot that is a tad unusual, a proposal to give one of the largest lakes in North America its own Bill of Rights. From the Marketplace Hub at WCPN IdeaStream in Cleveland, Adrian Ma explains whence the idea came and why not everybody is on board.
For Marky Miller, August 2nd, 2014 started off like any other day.
I remember waking up and took a shower, made coffee, turned on the news.
Thanks for staying with us on this extended edition on your Saturday morning at 13.
Not knowing why right away, just seeing all these warning signs.
A state of emergency is in effect for areas in and around Toledo where 400,000 people are being warned not to drink the water.
Don't touch it, don't bathe in it, don't brush your teeth, don't give your pets water. Luckily, I didn't drink the coffee.
Officials said giant floating sheets of algae in Lake Erie had produced dangerously high levels of microcystin, a toxin that can cause rashes, vomiting, and even liver damage. Within hours, bottled water was in short supply.
Folks went out this morning and they tried to buy up all the water they could find, and now there's none to be found.
The Toledo water crisis, as it's now called, lasted for 3 days. To avoid a repeat, the city's in the process of a $500 million upgrade to its water treatment plant. And yet, Miller says she worries because summertime algal blooms continue. The Ohio EPA says those blooms are fed in large part by nutrient runoff from farms and animal feedlots upriver.
What's in my water? I don't know if I can trust this now.
After the crisis, Miller joined a community group called Toledoans for Safe Water, which teamed up with a Pennsylvania nonprofit, the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, to get the Lake Erie Bill of Rights on Tuesday's ballot. If passed, it would give the lake a right to exist and flourish, and give Toledoans the right to sue polluters on the lake's behalf. Jonathan Adler teaches environmental law at Case Western Reserve University.
I'm very sympathetic to the concerns that prompt an initiative like this. I'm very skeptical of this particular way of doing it.
He says some provisions in the proposal conflict with state and federal law, so it's probably unenforceable. But similar rights of nature laws have passed in cities like Pittsburgh and Santa Monica, so opponents are taking it seriously. Earlier this month, a PAC called Toledo Jobs and Growth Coalition ran this radio ad.
What do these groups put in their Bill of Rights? The right to hurt local farmers. The right to hurt small businesses. The right to drive up our food costs.
And a big farm lobby in the state, the Ohio Farm Bureau, is also campaigning against it. Yvonne Lasisco is VP of Public Policy there.
We have businesses that every day are trying to meet the bottom line, and now, in addition to everything else that's on their plate, they're thinking to themselves, I could be sued tomorrow.
At his farm in Medina, Ohio, Michael Boyert grows soybeans and runs a small cattle operation. He's on the Farm Bureau's Board of Trustees and says, as someone who makes a living off the land, he gets the concern about Lake Erie.
It's a very valuable part of everybody's lifestyle, but it's the way that they're handling the situation that really needs to be looked at and fine-tuned.
He says in recent years, farmers have been doing more to reduce runoff, cutting down on fertilizer, planting cover crops, and storing animal waste. Still, the Ohio EPA says there have been algal blooms in recent summers that were more severe than the one that overwhelmed Toledo's water supply in 2014. That's why on this evening, Marky Miller is standing on a highway overpass with other members of Toledoans for Safe Water. They're setting up signs with big block letters for drivers to see.
Oh, and what is this going to say when it's done?
It'll say, vote yes, Lake Erie Bill of Rights.
If it does pass, Miller knows it may not hold up in court. But, kind of like their sign, she hopes it'll send a message. In Cleveland, I'm Adrian Ma for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, in which co-branding has its downsides. Shares of Stamps.com lost 50% this morning at the open, ended things down almost 58% from yesterday's close. How come, you ask? Because their revenue-sharing deal with a post office has fallen apart, which is tricky, right, if your company is, once again, Stamps.com. The CEO did say he's going to explore new deals with other carriers, FedEx, UPS, Amazon, but still, Stamps? All right, we are out of here. Dow Industrials up 181 today, 0.7%. The NASDAQ up 67 points, 0.9%. S&P 500 gained 17 points, 0.6%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Our executive editor is Evelyn LaRubia. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you Monday, everybody. Have yourselves a great weekend, all right? This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.